Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 20th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by Humanities Nebraska and the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Today's guest speaker will be David Reynolds, Professor of International History and a Fellow of Christ College, Cambridge University, as well as Chairman of the Faculty of History at Cambridge since October 2013. Professor Reynolds is the author of 11 books, including his most recent, The Long Shadow, Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century. He'll speak on the topic World War I, America's Forgotten War. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday evening, October 1st, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Humanities Nebraska, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts.
I am going to talk about David Reynolds. It's obviously a pleasure to be able to introduce him tonight. He is a professor of international history and a fellow at Christ College at the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom. He studied at Cambridge and Harvard Universities and has been a regular visitor to the United States since his days as a graduate student. In fact, we were talking earlier, and he actually did a little backpacking around the United States, taking a Greyhound pass, in fact, stopped in Omaha at that time. His time included two stops in Omaha. Professor Reynolds recently served for two academic years as chairman of Cambridge's Faculty of History from 2013 to 2015. Among Professor Reynolds' many honors include the Wolfson Prize for History in 2004, and elections as a fellow of the British Academy in 2005, and as a member of the Society of American Historians in 2011. He is the author of 11 books and three edited or co-edited volumes. His most recent book is The Long Shadow, Legacies of the Great War on the 20th Century, a book that I am enjoying, which was awarded the 2014 Hessel-Tiltman Prize. He has also written and presented 13 historical documentaries for BBC television, ranging across the international history of the 20th century, as well as the award-winning BBC Radio 4 series, America, Empire of Liberty. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me give a warm Nebraska welcome, Professor David Reynolds.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Governor, First Lady, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening. You stole my first line, which was to say that I have been here before when I was I had a Greyhound bus pass as a graduate student. I traveled for about 10 weeks all over the United States. And for me, that was an absolutely formative experience. I always say to my own students, do not think that if you have been to Boston and New York and San Francisco, you have seen the United States. The only way to see the United States is to travel across it, and in particular to travel across its heartlands, which I think is in many ways its heart. States like this are an essential part of what it is that makes America fundamentally different from Europe, from the countries of Europe. That's something I understood maybe in my head, but I only understood in my heart when I traveled on that Greyhound bus pass. And coming back here to Omaha on this visit, a brief one, has reinforced that sense of a state, a city that has so much going on, that is so proud of its own civic culture, is so distinctive and yet is so American in some of the best senses of the word. And that's what I think Humanities Nebraska is doing by that sense of taking the opportunities and the wealth that the city has generated and putting them into public programs, into the next generation, and so on. That's what I believe in as an educator, as a teacher. That's what Humanities Nebraska are doing. So I think it's not merely a pleasure, but a privilege to be here as part of that operation. So that's my preamble, but I'm going to talk now about America's Forgotten War. I'm just looking and getting my cue line. That's right, it's up here. Let me take you to Washington, D.C. There is no national World War I memorial in the nation's capital. If you think of the great center of the nation's memory on the Mall, from the Washington Monument down to the Lincoln Memorial, there's a World War II memorial. There's a memorial to the Korean War. There's a memorial to the Vietnam War. Meyer Lin's very striking black stone V etched into the ground. There is, in the trees, if you look for it, a small, rather ramshackle dome, which is the District of Columbia memorial to the 499 men of the district who died in the First World War. But that is just for D.C. There is no national monument. That, for me, sums up the sense of this war as America's forgotten war, and that's what I want to talk about this evening. In Europe, or certainly in my own country, in Britain, the war of 1914-18, which is what it was in Europe, is still known as the Great War. The Great War. It's the war in which the largest number of British soldiers lost their lives, 750,000. For this country, I think your Great War is still the war of 1861 to 65. That's very different from what George Kennan called the seminal catastrophe of the 20th century, the Great War. 10 million dead, the collapse of four great empires that had ruled Eastern and Central Europe for much of the last 300 or 400 years, the Romanovs in Russia, the Habsburgs in Austria-Hungary, the Hohenzollerns in Germany, Ottomans in Turkey and southeastern Europe. And out of that massive geopolitical train crash, if you like, came a whole lot of issues and crises that have really shaped Europe for the rest of the 20th century. Bolshevik revolution in Russia, desire for revenge in Germany, for its defeat, which fed into the Nazis and Hitler. A whole series of fractious and fragile new states in Central and Eastern Europe, countries like Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and so on, whose disputes between each other, whose ethnic minorities were the fuel for the next war that Germany, Hitler, capitalized upon. And if you want to think of the resonance of these issues still in the present day, you only have to think of two countries, Ukraine and Iraq. The Ukrainian question not settled at the end of the First World War, their bid for statehood. Iraq, a fragile new state created out of nothing by the British from the ruins of the Ottoman Empire. Two countries that are still in our headlines today, a century later. That's Europe's Great War. That's Europe's seminal catastrophe, the one that shaped in so many ways the 20th century. Your Great War, as I say, is 1861 to 65. 750,000 dead. The death toll has been recalibrated in the last year or two. So kind of equivalent to Britain's Great War. And those images remind us that it was in many ways the precursor of European war. This is a foretaste of the war to come in Europe, something that European military historians appreciated belatedly in the 1920s, but not at the time. And of course, that Great War and the issues around which it revolved, above all the issue of slavery and race relations, are still issues that face the United States today. By contrast, America's forgotten war, America's involvement in the European war, was an 18-month affair from April 1917 to November 1918. 4.7 million men are mobilized, 116,000 dead. But actually, that's a slightly illusory figure because, or misleading figure, 53,000 die in combat. The rest are soldiers who die of various causes in uniform, but most of the other dead are from the influenza epidemic of at the end of the First World War, which, of course, takes away far more people, both in America and in Europe, than the war itself, something we often forget. Moreover, those 53,000 soldiers, most of them die in the last couple of months of the conflict. When the United States forces are thrown into battle, particularly in the southern part of the Western Front, the Meuse-Argonne particularly, and they take terrible casualties, casualties that eclipse the great battles of the Civil War, and which, if they'd been sustained for another few months, I think probably would have caused a huge outcry in the United States, because, in fact, what is happening in America is that belatedly American generals are learning what British and French generals have learnt the hard way over the previous few years, that straightforward infantry attacks against enemy positions with machine guns and heavy artillery are actually suicidal. So this is a war that stops, not exactly before it started, but before it's really got going for the United States. And that's part of the reason, I think, why it has been forgotten. Nevertheless, it leaves lasting legacies. And I want to talk about some of those this evening. One of them is to do with the central one, really, is the whole story of President Woodrow Wilson, 28th President of the United States, a figure who in some ways is also forgotten, but is, I think, a hugely important figure in your history and in the 20th century. Wilson in 1914 was quite clear that the United States should not be part of this war. He was an Anglophile by instinct, but he had a sense of a country that was really almost molten in its change at the time, not just the great economic and social developments, but also the huge ethnic mix of the country. And for Wilson, it was clear he felt that if the United States got involved in this war, given the ethnic mix, it would almost become a civil war in the United States. And of course, in this state, there was a substantial community of German Americans, and that was a big issue in state politics. The issue of prohibition, for example, revolved around ethnic and cultural issues. So Wilson's instinct was right. I'll come back to the ethnic question in a moment. But Wilson, rather fatefully, also decided that neutrality should not mean that America kind of stood away from all this in a timid way, that America, he felt, must exercise its rights as a neutral country to carry on trading in time of war with the belligerents and not allow their war and warlike activity to overtake the rest of the human race. And that decision not to curtail American trade, of course, leads to crises like the Lusitania, when Americans traveling on a passenger vessel belonging to the British, which actually, as we now know, carried some contraband, weapons of war, are lost. 128 Americans, a really powerful emotional moment in the story of the war. Wilson's insistence on neutral rights is central to the way that America is drawn into this conflict. He wants to remain at peace, he wants to keep the country out of war, but not at the price of its rights as a country. And that gradually sucks him in more and more to the conflict, particularly when the Germans start unrestricted submarine warfare to try and cut the lifeline between the United States and Britain. So that takes us very rapidly to the position that Wilson finds himself by the spring of 1917, when he finally goes to the US Congress and asks for a declaration of war against unrestricted German submarine warfare. And he uses those famous and fateful words that have, in a sense, echoed around the world, I think, for much of the 20th century. The world must be made safe for democracy. Must be made safe for democracy. The Congress gives him approval. 6 members of the Senate vote against, only 6. One of them is a senator from this state, George Norris, who is quite convinced that this is a war for munitions manufacturers and bankers. It is not a war that will help real people. Wilson is cheered back to the White House. He rides back in silence with his wife, absolutely exhausted, and afterwards he slumps in a chair and he says to his press secretary, it is amazing that they cheer us. My message today was a message of death for our young men. How strange it seems to applaud that. $4.7 million soldiers are mobilized. A couple of million of those go to France. But this is also a war that does affect the United States. It does affect over here as well as over there. The propaganda that is developed to justify the war is often quite brutal. I think we've got that poster outside. It reflects the kind of propaganda that was used in Britain and France earlier in the war. You see here the Hun, the German, is shown as a kind of mad brute, an animal taking away women and children. And that anti-enemy, what was explicitly an anti-German campaign, carries on at the end of the war into a program of a commitment to 100% Americanism, as it's known, taking the hyphenate out of politics, not German Americans, but 100% Americans. And that has an interesting effect right here in the state of Nebraska. There is a case that goes all the way to the Supreme Court in 1923, and it's regarded by lawyers, I think, as a landmark case in civil liberties. The case of Meyer versus State of Nebraska. Robert T. Meyer was an instructor at a parochial school, Lutheran parochial school in Hampton, Nebraska. And he was prosecuted for infringing the Seaman Act, which was passed by the state of Nebraska in 1919, against the teaching of any use of any other language than English in the classroom. All teaching had to be done in English. And even if you were, any teaching of foreign languages could only be done for children above the eighth grade. Meyer was caught allowing a student to read the Bible in German. He was prosecuted, he was fined $25. He took the case right through the state system and up to the US Supreme Court. And in a landmark decision in 1923, the Supreme Court voted 7-2. That this was a breach of civil liberties. They prosecuted under the due process clause of the Constitution. It's probably a First Amendment issue now, but nevertheless, it's been taken as a landmark case in civil liberties. So here is an example of how the arguments about the war and about what America should be like came right home to this state. There are so many ways that I could follow this story of the war through, but the one I want to follow is the thread, if you like, is the person Woodrow Wilson. Because his story is fascinating, and also it has haunted, I think, American politicians, particularly Democratic politicians, right through the 20th century. But not just Democrats. Wilson goes to Paris for the peace conference in 1919 in triumph. He tries to put into practice that idea of a world made safe for democracy, focused particularly on his notion of a League of Nations. But as you know, that is rejected by the US Senate. Wilson goes on a whistle-stop tour all over the country. I think he comes through Nebraska, trying to persuade the people to put pressure on their own representatives, their own senators. In the process, Wilson exhausts himself. He has a stroke. He is forced to end the trip, go back to Washington. The League of Nations and the peace treaty do not go through the Senate. And the rest of Wilson's presidency, in a way that is hushed up quite remarkably to our imagination today, Wilson is a cripple. The White House is run to a large extent by his wife and his staff. And people don't really know this. They don't really know the extent to which he has become a paralyzed president. Wilson lasts out to the end of his presidency in March 1921, but very quickly his legacy, his achievements are very much in disrepute. He's reduced, if you like, to a postage stamp by 1925, 17 cents. It's about the value that many people would have put on him in the 1920s. The world has moved on. And although the soldiers, the American soldiers, the doughboys who fought in that war are honored, there is a growing sense that this was a mistake, a growing sense in America that involvement in the war was a mistake, particularly once the Depression hits, once there is a great backlash against bankers and businessmen, the so-called merchants of death. Here is one of the sensationalist books of the 1930s that castigated the munitions manufacturers and the bankers who supposedly had dragged America into war, just as George Norris had said and warned about in 1917. The Nye Commission, Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota, here confronting J.P. Morgan across the table, a long Senate commission into the arms industry in the First World War, not really finding a smoking gun, but uncovering a huge amount of dirt, which has which really damaged the image of companies like Morgan's. Ernest Hemingway sums up the really isolationist mood of the mid-30s. We were fools to be sucked in once to a European war, and we shall never be sucked in again. As I say, the soldiers who fought in that war are honored. But for politicians, Wilson is a problem, not least for Franklin D. Roosevelt. Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy through the Wilson administration. He was close to the president. But in the 1920s, he distanced himself from the Wilson legacy. Roosevelt also, of course, had to come to terms with polio. The end of the Wilson presidency was also the just about the time when Roosevelt was afflicted by polio and left literally paralyzed from the waist down, or at least, as Joseph Stilwell, Vinegar Joe, said of him in the Second World War, called Roosevelt rubber legs. It was a nasty term, but it was true. Roosevelt was unable to stand unaided. He had to be helped to dress and undress. He had to be heaved into bed at night. He had to be helped on the toilet. This was an endless humiliation for a man who had been once very strong and very powerful. And the sense of personal paralysis that he had accentuated his sense of the political paralysis that had hit Wilson by the end of the war. Robert Sherwood, who was his scriptwriter and biographer, said the tragedy of Wilson was always within the rim of his consciousness. A president who got out in front of public opinion and had found himself politically paralyzed and personally paralyzed as a result. Roosevelt's leadership, his cautious, often devious leadership in bringing America into the Second World War, was very much a reaction to the dangers he saw in Wilson's approach of marching, of leading from the front. So this mixed legacy, soldiers who are honored. Here's Sergeant York, one of the great almost mythical figures of the First World War. Alvin York, a soldier from Tennessee, a mountain boy who won the Medal of Honor for capturing a German machine gun nest and taking, I think, 130 soldiers prisoner. The movie comes out rather late in 1941. There he is, Gary Cooper, you know, the young Gary Cooper. But it celebrates the soldiers. But the political legacy is problematic, at least until Pearl Harbor. One of the things I found in writing my book was that in all the countries involved in the First World War, whether it's France or Britain or Russia or the United States, the First War looks different when there's a Second War. And countries have seen the First War in relation to the Second World War in different ways. I haven't got time to go into it tonight, but I've talked about it in the book. For the United States, the Second War, which is clearly a war that America has an interest in, Pearl Harbor is bombed, there is a sense that we're fighting a bestial regime in Europe. This has a clarity and a moral purpose that the First War lacked. In 1944, there is a major movie about Wilson, which resurrects this once denigrated president and portrays him as a kind of far-sighted prophet of the future, a man who tried to lead America into a world role, was rejected by small-minded, petty politicians in the Senate, but whose ideas are now coming of age. When the State Department is trying to sell the United Nations to the American people, it talks about it explicitly as America's second chance for world leadership. We kind of blew it the first time in the Wilson era, let's not blow it again. And you can suddenly see the way that the world is reconfigured in the American imagination during the course of the Second World War. Here is here are two views of the Atlantic Ocean from maps of the time. From the 1930s, here's the standard view you would have got in an American atlas, an atlas that was in school and so on. You can see here a Western Hemisphere, which is protected by huge oceans on either side, the Atlantic and the Pacific, a sense of a Western Hemisphere that's secure and almost invulnerable. That's, if you like, the isolationist America. It's the one that can say, we can stand Fortress America alone. Here's the kind of image that Franklin Roosevelt projected and which interventionists, those who wanted America to get into the Second War, presented of the Atlantic. As a lake in the middle of something called the Atlantic area. And that's 1941. The term North Atlantic Alliance is not used till 1949, but the Atlantic area is part of this reconfiguration of the sort of geopolitical imagination of America that is going on and is being encouraged by those who say, this is our fight, we can't stand out of it, because air power is going to change the nature of battle because we cannot be immune from the changes in the balance of power in Europe. Walter Lippmann sums this up in 1943 in a book called about US foreign policy. He says, the Atlantic is not a frontier between America and Europe. It is an inland sea, a community of nations allied with one another by geography, history, and vital necessity. Lippmann had said that in 1917 when America was coming into war, but it was an idea that was not yet, its time had not yet come. That book is a bestseller in America. It's actually a miniature edition, is given to troops. It's the point at which, in a sense, America's coming of age as a world power can be seen, this new vision of the Atlantic as a bridge and not a barrier. World War II has become, if you like, America's good war. Studs Terkel's phrase from much later, but it's there, I think, morally right from the start. A war that can be celebrated, perhaps above all, this is perhaps the most iconic of the memorials, the Iwo Jima Memorial of U.S. Marine Corps just outside Arlington National Cemetery, that famous picture, I think, by Joe Rosenthal of the Marines putting the flag, the Stars and Stripes, on this ravaged atoll of Iwo Jima on top of the Japanese and American dead. It's such a hard-fought battle, but a sense of hard-won triumph. That's a good war that looks even better when America has gone through the trauma of Vietnam and has started to ask questions about its role in the world. And it still stands that way today. Tom Brokaw's phrase about the greatest generation is, I think, one that still resonates for lots of people in this country, as it does in many ways for British people as well. Our Second World War is much easier to understand than our First World War. But Wilson still runs through the American political imagination in the second half of the 20th century. Lyndon Johnson and Vietnam. That's a picture of Johnson in 1968 when it's all going wrong, a few weeks before he announces that he's not going to run for another term, when everything is going wrong at Khe San and the Tet Offensive and so on. And at that time, Johnson could not sleep. Often in the White House, he would go downstairs to the map rooms and the sand tables, and he would look at the shapes of the places that he was trying to fight for. And he had a recurring dream, or it was an adaptation of an old recurring dream, about his grandmother, who had been a pioneer figure out in eastern Texas, a once very strong and powerful woman who had been ravaged by a stroke. And he remembered her just sitting in a kind of comatose way in a rocking chair on the porch, unable to move, and imagining a stampede of cattle coming towards her. And when in those last few weeks, or the early weeks of 1968 in the White House, he had a variant of that dream, which was that he saw himself, as if from above, lying in a bed, dead, and people around him discussing Johnson's legacy. And he would wake up and he would walk downstairs and he would find the picture of Wilson in the corridor below, and he would put his hands on the picture and he would confirm to himself that it was Wilson who was dead, it was Wilson's body he was looking at and not his own. It was a very powerful image of a paralyzed president that had haunted Roosevelt and haunted Wilson, haunted Johnson, that was now very vivid in his own mind. Wilson also is reconfigured during the Cold War. A whole series of American historians, this is perhaps the most famous, William Appleman Williams, depicting the essential drama of the First World War as that of 1917, the Russian Revolution, the challenge of the Russian Revolution, the struggle between Wilson and Lenin, that then, in a sense, prefigures and shapes the whole of the Cold War. That's a different kind of Wilson, a sort of an aggressive anti-communist version of democracy. Wilson has been reconfigured again in the 21st century, not this time by Democrats, but by Republicans. In the aftermath of 9/11, the ambition to make the Middle East safe for democracy is an ambition espoused by many people in the Bush administration. Figures like Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, neoconservatives like Charles Krauthammer. One of them, Lawrence Kaplan, said that Bush should complete the job that Wilson started, that Bush is the most Wilsonian president we've had since Wilson himself. That sense of bringing democracy to the wider world, in this case, the Middle East. So here's a president whose legacy has been seen in different ways at different times in the 20th century and the 21st century, whose war has, I think, and the aspirations behind that war of bringing the values of American democracy to a wider world has been argued about, contested over the last 100 years. That's just one aspect of the ways in which I think the story of the First World War has continued to shape America, why it's still important and interesting today. In many countries, in all the belligerent countries involved in the First World War, there was a very powerful and moving moment when the last recognized, identified soldier of that war passed away. The last Tommy in Britain. My wife and I went to a service in Westminster Abbey that honoured the last Tommy. Same was true in France, Australia, and so on. The last doughboy was Frank Buckles. He died in 2011. But there is still no World War I National Memorial. There is still just that rather forlorn little little Doric temple in the backwoods of the of Washington, D.C. There has, in fact, as you probably know, been a long debate about whether there should be a national memorial on the Mall with these other great memorials. In the end, the Congress decided or passed a bill, was attached to a bill in earlier this year, that there would not be a national memorial on that site, but there was space for the building of a privately funded memorial on Pershing Park, some way away on Pennsylvania Avenue and 14th Street Northwest. There is a statue of General Pershing, of course, a soldier that had a connection with this state. He was, I think, for about 5 years in the 1890s, a professor at UNL, taught military strategy there, and there is a unit, of a drill unit called the Pershing Rifles, which he set up, which is still, in a sense, commemorating his name. But Pershing's statue is there, and that's the area around it where a memorial can be built if private money is raised for it. So it's an interesting sense of this still a war that is somewhat on the edge of America's memory. What I hope I've done tonight is at least suggest to you a few ways in which I think it should not be just on the edge of America's memory, that the past should be remembered, commemorated, and I hope 100 years on, understood. That's what I've tried to do in this lecture. That's what I've tried to do in this book. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, David. I'm Will Thomas. I'm the Engel Professor in the Humanities at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. And it's my pleasure to moderate question and answers from the audience for David. If you have a question you'd like to pose to David, there are detachable forms in your program. Write out your question, hand it to one of the ambassadors, the ushers, and they'll bring it up here to us. And so at the end of the evening, David's generously agreed to sign copies of his book. They'll be available in the lobby, and David will sign copies there after we conclude. If you're an event sponsor, you may pick up your signed books in the lobby. I just think I'd like to start, if I can throw one question out at you first, while we're gathering some questions from the audience. You talked about the local memorialization in Washington, D.C., and the lack of a national memorial. On the campus at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, we have a bell tower that peals every 15 minutes in memory of the World War I dead. And I think college campuses all over the country have these monuments. And so I guess I'd like to know from your standpoint, what explains this lack of a national memory, and yet the preservation of a kind of a local memory?
Yes, what you say about college campuses is true, and I think also of there are many civic memorials around the country commemorating the soldiers from various communities that went to fight. Often very beautiful and striking memorials designed by significant sculptures and paid for by local family donations. I think that the memory of the soldiers, what remained strong and powerful, there was a strong tradition of also battlefield pilgrimages by the bereaved in the 1920s and 1930s, going back to the places where their sons had fought and died. But I think the as it were, the lack of clarity about at the national level in national politics about whether this had been a good war, in a sense, poisoned the project of national commemoration. there really wasn't a debate in 1945 about whether this had been a good war. The enemy was completely defeated. Germany was occupied. Hitler was dead. The camps had been opened. You could see the bestiality of the Nazi regime. And the United States had moved to a position of world power. The legacies of the First World War were much more ambiguous, less decisive. Wilson was a very divisive figure, and I think that that, in a sense, affected the willingness at the level of national politics to say, OK, we can actually talk about this war in a way and commemorate it successfully at a national level.
No. The United States entered the war in 1917, but, of course, the United States really entered the war, you might say, much earlier than that, began preparing for the war much earlier than that. What do you think would have happened if the United States had not entered World War I?
Well, Wilson's policy of neutrality and neutral rights is, in a sense, gets him into a position by 1917 where he is brought into the war completely. But it reflects the natural links that already existed between the United States and Britain, particularly in economic terms and financial terms. The number of American banking companies that, like Morgan's, that had affiliates on both sides of the Atlantic, the patterns of trade that had existed between the U.S. and Britain. And so when Wilson said, OK, you know, Americans should be free to travel and trade as they want, there was a natural bias towards the British side. Long before the United States entered the war, American loans were funding, by the end of 1916, 40% of the daily cost of the war, of Britain's war, was being funded by American loans. And, of course, it's one of the aspects of the First World War that it turns the American financial system outwards from investment within the country and the growth of this country in the late 19th century to investment abroad. So without that American assistance, the British and French war effort would have been much less easy to run up to 1917. Although the Doughboys don't make a huge contribution, a decisive contribution to the battle in 1918, it's quite clear to the Germans that if the war goes on to 1919, there will be a massive American presence on the Western Front, and that, in a sense, is part of what breaks German will and particularly army morale in the course of 1918 and leads to the collapse. So there are many ways, indeed, in which the United States' involvement in the war is much more than simply those 53,000 soldiers who died in those battles in the last few months.
So from our audience, which country was most impacted by World War I and why?
Well, part of what's striking is that so many countries were. The two that I think you would single out are in different ways, Russia and Germany. Russia, because it brings down the most repressive autocracy in Europe, the one that seems strongest, toughest, and most brutal. And, of course, it's ironic that the first revolution, February Revolution in St. Petersburg, the regime collapses in less than 2 weeks, mostly from a series of protests that go on in an area of not much bigger than downtown Omaha, really. But the whole regime collapses. From that, of course, and from the ruins of that, comes the Bolshevik Revolution, which is so important for shaping Europe throughout the 20th century. So that would be one. The other, of course, is Germany. The Germans are persuaded all through the war by their propaganda that victory is just around the corner. When suddenly, on the 4th of October or the 5th of October, they learn the news, 1918, that their high command has asked for an armistice with the Allies, there is absolute incredulity, anger, fury on the part of the right, a sense of opportunity on the part of the left, and the Kaiser's regime again collapses in a matter of weeks, leaving behind a legacy, particularly on the right, that we was robbed. How did this happen? You know, we were winning. We were fighting on foreign soil. The German army is still in France and Belgium at the end of 1918, November 1918, when the armistice is signed. So we're not clearly defeated. The only explanation for this is that we were stabbed in the back by the treacherous people at home. You blame the pacifists, the Bolsheviks, above all the Jews. That's Hitler's line, but it's not just Hitler's line. That's the feed, that's the fodder for the next war. That is the arguments that are so powerful in persuading Germany to embark on another war to redeem what seems to them the lost victory that's just been taken away from them. So I would say Russia and Germany, but the striking thing about that war is that all the countries of Europe are fundamentally affected in all sorts of ways. It is, as Kennan said, the seminal catastrophe of the 20th century in Europe.
Yeah. Your book described the Britishness that was coming together in the war, and one of the things that amazed me was the high number of volunteers, British volunteers in the war, 43%, I think you wrote, this extraordinary British volunteerism for World War I. And so this question really gets at part of that from the audience. And this is asking, how does America's memory of World War I compare to Great Britain's memory of World War I? So what are the differences between those memories?
Well, you mentioned the volunteering. In Britain, one of the things that was very totally different from the continent of Europe, and I say the continent of Europe, most people in Britain would still say Europe. They think we are completely separate from Europe, 21 miles away across the Channel. For many British people, the so-called English Channel is wider than the Atlantic Ocean, mentally anyway. But the point was that Britain did not have a tradition of conscription of the draft, like all the continental countries. You had a conscription, you served for a period of time, then you were in the reserves. So that in July 1914, France, Germany, Russia could mobilize large numbers of men. Britain had a regular army. It had a detestation of a standing army, going back to our English Civil War. So that when it was necessary to raise a large army, it was a volunteer army. And one of the reasons why things like war poetry was so strong in Britain was that it was about arousing emotion and getting people to feel this sort of patriotic tug that would make them sign up. Many of them signed up in what were known as pals battalions. In other words, people from the neighbourhood, the streets around them, enlisting en masse and going to fight en masse. And part of what is so poignant about the Battle of the Somme in Britain is that that was many of those PALS battalions, as they were known. And there are PALS, the equivalent in cities like Kansas City in America as well, but were actually just decimated in the Battle of the Somme. So huge numbers of people in a few streets in a neighborhood lost their own children. And so that is a very powerful part of British memory, that sense of young men sacrificed in a way that you could really just put your finger on regionally and so on. What's interesting is that the United States starts off the very beginning of the war, the assumption is it will be volunteers. And then within a few days or weeks, it becomes clear that if you let people volunteer, it will completely destroy the economy. Because skilled labour will join up and all the rest of it, and suddenly, the munitions factories or the food supply or whatever it is, or the farms will be denuded of skilled labour. So within, I think, about 6 weeks, Wilson imposes conscription of the draft in this country. And that, of course, becomes then another part of this, the complexity of this war morally, that you are fighting for freedom and liberty, but you're doing it in a coerced way. I mean, all sorts of radical things like taking over the railroads by the federal government in the war. You know, these are things, obviously, that are prefigured by the Civil War in certain ways, but, are part of the kind of moral problem. For the British and the Americans, I think it is a war over there. Over there is 21 miles. For the British, 3,000 miles or 4,500 miles if you were here. For the Americans. And so there is this sense of you're not fighting for your own soil, like the French were, for example, who were occupied by the Germans. But I think America's war would have been less forgotten if it hadn't been so relatively brief. For the British, it's 4 years, it's 750,000 dead. You can't go through the 1920s without being aware of that sense of loss and sitting and saying to yourself, well, what actually was achieved? And I think that's part of what still nags at British memory. Second World War is straightforward. We were bombed. We were threatened by invasion. We were fighting for our own liberty as a country. First World War, not quite so clear what it's all about, and I think that's still a problem for the British today.
Mm-hmm. I can't resist this question as a Civil War scholar. It's a bit of a provocative question, David. If the Civil War is the great war for the United States, should we not also have a Civil War memorial on the National Mall?
Well,
we'd like an outsider's perspective.
I mean, it goes back to the point I've made. I think that that's still a war which is too hot to handle in many ways.
Yeah.
What is interesting, I found about, and this is an oblique answer to your question, about the Vietnam Memorial, is that it is so different from that the Marine Memorial, the Iwo Jima Memorial that you have at Arlington National Cemetery. And the names that are carved there of the American dead in Vietnam, the idea for that came to Maya Lin, who was a graduate student in architecture at Yale, 21, I think she was, very young, from a course that she'd taken with the architectural historian Vincent Scully about British memorials of the First World War, and in particular the memorial at Thiepval on the Somme, to the missing of the Somme, to 72,000 men who died somewhere in the Somme but whose remains were never found. And it's simply a list of names. It's hugely evocative. And it made me think, and this is what I wrote about at the end of the book, that actually if a war is positive and you feel you've come out of it with a sense of accomplishment, you can build a monument like that Marines Memorial, which is heroic, which is suffering, but it says something proud. If a war is problematic, as Vietnam was, it's not clear that you can build a memorial like that. You actually do something that simply commemorates the suffering of a war. So I would say that the answer to your question about the Civil War is rather similar. I can't imagine a memorial to that which could begin to address all the issues that come out of it in a conflicted national memory. So perhaps all you could do was commemorate in some way the suffering that was involved in that for all the people involved, and I don't know how you'd begin to do that, really. Mm-hmm. But the idea of having a national monument to the Civil War is, it's almost a contradiction in terms, because it was about, you know, two different conceptions of nationhood and about, you know, the idea of a separate nation of the Confederate States of America. So it's almost a contradiction in terms.
Yeah. Couple more questions. This one is about World War I creating the modern international system, mm-hmm. the League of Nations, eventually the United Nations. Do you think the history of nations in the 100 years since then has been largely positive or negative?
Well, I mean, nationalism has been one of the great, in many ways, great curses of the 20th century, certainly in Europe. If I answer the question perhaps better by just focusing it a little bit more sharply. The First World War and the Second World War are centrally about battles between France and Germany. And those battles are in themselves part of a cycle of wars that goes back several centuries, maybe about 20 conflicts between the French and the Germans in various configurations. In 1945, it would be predictable that those countries would simply carry on this tit-for-tat nationalism. That it was this time the Germans were down, so they would say, OK, we're going to get our revenge on the French, just like the French had said, we'll get our revenge on the Germans after, you know, the First World War, after the Franco-Prussian War, whatever. Nobody would have predicted in 1945 that 12 years later, the French and the Germans were founding members of the European Economic Community, as it was then known, what's become since the European Union. Now, the European Union has huge problems. It's incredibly ineffective. It's not done anything effective over the euro crisis, a whole lot of things, the refugee crisis and all the rest of it. It's very difficult to defend. In this country, in Britain, we will have a referendum on whether we should stay in the European Union in a couple of years' time. What I say to students and what I'd say to you is that that has at least been a way in which France and Germany have come together. They have transcended that incessant, brutal, bloody nationalism that had ravaged their countries and Europe for three centuries. I would reckon that bureaucratic inertia and a certain amount of wasted money are a small price to pay for the fact that France and Germany have not fought each other in the last 60 years, and there is no likelihood that they will ever do so again. So for me, nationalism has been a real problem. Where there have been ways of moving beyond it, as in the case of the European Union, I think it has been very important. I am enormously proud to be British, or particularly English. I have no doubt that you are enormously proud to be Americans. What I would say is that it's important to be able to understand other countries and begin to appreciate their own perspectives. That's really why I wrote that book, in a way, to say, okay, we'll understand each other's memories of these wars better if we compare them, rather than simply talk about American memory or British memory and so on. So, I have a sense of nationhood. I'm also very aware of the dangers of nationalism. Mm.
David, I could sit here all night and ask you questions, I think, and listen to your answers. I think we have to conclude this evening, and I hope you'll join me in thanking David. Let's thank you, David.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the 20th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by Humanities Nebraska and the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Today's guest speaker has been David Reynolds, Professor of International History and a Fellow of Christ College, Cambridge University, as well as Chairman of the Faculty of History at Cambridge since October 2013. Professor Reynolds is the author of 11 books, including his most recent, The Long Shadow, Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century. He spoke on the topic World War I, America's Forgotten War. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday evening, October 1st, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Christopher Summerick, Executive Director of Humanities Nebraska, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.